Thanks everybody for coming today on a beautiful, beautiful afternoon. My name is Terry Kylo. I'm a Lutheran pastor for 28 years. I live about 80 miles as the crow flies that way. So one of these days, I want to come in and on the trails with my spouse and come in all nice and dirty. So I've been working. About five years ago now, I began. Actually, more than that, time is flying. I got into an interfaith dialogue with a Muslim and a Buddhist in Marysville, Washington. It was kind of the first time any of that had happened in Marysville. And we started having these conversations. It was really great. And then I was invited by some folk in Oak Harbor, Washington, which is a military town, kind of a Naval Air Force town, Naval Air Station, to come in and do something on Islam. And so we did this. And I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea. But my Muslim friend was really good, and we had an incredibly powerful event with 90 people who showed up. Ooh. And kind of like some magic happened. Like this lady that was totally freaked out by Muslims actually gave him a hug. I mean, it was really great. And we did like four or five more of those, and I was learning more. And what happened is I began to learn some things that really disturbed me. Because as a Lutheran, when I went to seminary, you know, we all read about Dietrich Bonhoeffer and read some of his works. We read about sort of some of the resistance to the Nazis and to their ideology in the 1930s and 40s. We also read how they fell short of success in terms of pushing back on all that. And what I began to learn was that there was actually an intentional dehumanization campaign that's well-funded that is happening in this country. And when I read that, something really changed for me. And then I'll tell you maybe a little more about my story. Well, I'll just share. We kept doing events, and then the Paris attack happened, and Muslims began to experience in our area in Western Washington a lot of microaggressions and actually vandalism of shops and restaurants that they owned, and some violence against individuals. And it was really terrible. And so my friend and I were sitting down for tea, and I said, let's do something about this. So we put on an event. And in between putting on that event and kind of announcing it to the public, a larger event sponsored by a church and a mosque, the San Bernardino attack happened. And then a presidential candidate quoting a hate industry false study said that we had to have a total and complete shutdown of all Muslims coming into the country. And so at this event that we had planned for maybe 150 people, we ended up having 450 people show up. And because of the chatter that was going on, we had to have police protection for the event. And the media showed up. And the next morning, I got emails from faith leaders all over Western Washington asking, could they host an event like that at their place? Because they also had read about how dehumanization works and how it had taken place in Germany and in other places. So we all know right now that we have an awful lot of hate groups that are growing in this country.
Terry, would you adjust your mic? You're going in and out of the...
Okay, thank you very much, John. Yeah, let me know if that's any better.
That's fine.
So we all know that we've got a lot of hate groups growing in this country. And it's gaining speed. There was a big jump after the last election, and then it kind of like moderated, but then we see this continual steady growth. And here we have a bunch of neo-Nazis saying that Jews will not replace us, carrying tiki torches and frightening people. And we know what has happened in some of these events, that people have been killed and run over by automobiles. And that there is this kind of incredible, there must be the battery.
Somebody pulled the antenna off the bottom of it.
Oh dear. Somebody pulled the antenna off the bottom of it.
This piece.
Okay.
It's supposed to go here. It just.
Okay.
So let's not use that. You can use this or you can use that.
Okay.
Would this be okay to use?
Sure.
Okay.
I'll do my best.
Yeah. I'll turn you up.
Okay. I'll do my best. How's that, friends? Is that a little bit better?
Yes.
All right. You better crank it up a little bit, because I'm a wanderer. So I know probably most of you are really concerned about these increasing hate groups across the country. Southern Poverty Law Center has been tracking that. Other groups have been tracking that kind of rise in hate. And just for people in Western Washington, I'm sorry, that's not the one supposed to be there. We have to ask ourselves why this is happening. What are the factors underneath it? And I like to think of it and talk about it as kind of a big stew pot with a lot of Bunsen burners underneath it. We have a very strong tendency in the United States, and as human beings perhaps, to sort of like reduce everything to one factor. And oftentimes we ignore the factors that make us uncomfortable, right? So what I want to try to do is present a case here a little bit at the beginning of this for some of the factors that are at play in why hate groups are on the rise at this particular moment. And I'm going to leave some out, I'm sure. So I want to start with the U.S. economy, which is only one. What we see here in this chart is that U.S. productivity and real hourly compensation somehow split around 1975. And their productivity has been going up, ever increasing, but the hourly compensation for manufacturing jobs in this country has gone rather flat and has stayed flat for a long time. We know that about 1983, somewhere around in there, we began to see an incredible shift where the net wealth held by the 0.1% began to grow and is now at the same rate or even higher than 90% of the rest of the population, which means the currency that's supposed to flow around in an economy is getting stuck at the top. But we've also seen at the very same time, and this is a little bit darker chart here, I apologize for that, is that the asset prices in this country have, with some ups and downs, risen actually quite a lot, which means that if you want to buy a home or you want to rent an apartment, it's very, very difficult to do that on wages that have stayed flat, given inflation, since about 1975. And we also know that there's, of course, quite a few different economies in our economy. We know that 40 plus percent of Americans cannot afford a $400 emergency. We know that people who have a high school education or less have seen their wages fall by 18% since 1980. We know that the middle class in this country has shrunk. We also know that all those economic factors impact our people of color far more than they impact white folk. So all of that is happening all together, and of course the typical answer is, well, the reason that some of these wages are low is because of globalization, and that of course plays a huge role. But there's another factor that we really need our politicians to begin to share even more, which is that 85% of job losses in this country in manufacturing in the first decade of this century were due to automation and mechanization. So what's happening is that the fourth industrial revolution, mechanization and automation, is taking over manufacturing. Not exactly eliminating jobs, but eliminate the number of them. So instead of a factory that has 400, you're gonna have a factory that has 40. And the job skills required to be one of those folk is really, really changed. And what if you just don't happen to be one of those folk? And so I can talk about my own hometown, which is east of here, La Crosse, Washington, a town of 300 people. When my brother graduated from high school, they had 24 students, which is not very many. When I graduated, they had 13. Now they graduate one or two. Why is that? And that's because when my dad was a kid, it took about 15 people in the fields, another 6 in the kitchen, 22 mules, and 40 days to harvest 600 acres. Today it takes 3 people, maybe 4, about 35 days to harvest 10,000 acres. So there's no need for farmhands. There's no need for, and all the farms have gotten bigger, right? Because the machines are so expensive. And the margin for those farmers is very small, so they can't make it if they don't have a lot of land. So that's happening across rural and manufacturing sections across this country, which a lot of folks that live out in more urban or suburban areas just have no clue about. And about the rage that's happening out there because they feel left behind. We also know in this country that about 50% of Americans are chronically lonely. And what happens when we're lonely? Right? Our brain chemistry, our hormones actually change. And we begin to be more fearful. And what do we do when we're lonely? We turn on the TV or the radio, or we get on the Google machine. And what does the Google machine do? It's learning all the time what we like, and it's feeding us more of what we like, and it's leading us to be ever more and more and more convinced that we're the only ones out there. Our point of view is the only one that's right, and everybody else is totally crazy. And then what has happened in this country, in part, is that people look around at this economy that they're struggling to survive in, that they can't imagine their kids with student debt being able to live the life that they hope for them. They look around and they see a more diverse America, and what do? And more precisely, what do our political leaders do? Well, what we do is we confuse the cause of something with the appearance of something, right? Causation with correlation. We confuse those two. And so, as W.E.B. Du Bois said in his book, Black Reconstruction in America in 1935, back of the writhing, yelling, cruel-eyed demons who break, destroy, maim, and lynch, and burn at the stake is a knot, large or small, of normal human beings. And these human beings at heart are desperately afraid of something. Of what? Of many things, but usually of losing their jobs, being declassed, degraded, or actually disgraced, of losing their hopes, their savings, their plans for their children, of the actual pangs of hunger, of dirt, of crime. So W.E.B. Du Bois is absolutely on fire to say that there are people out there who are completely captivated by racism. But there is also another group that is plenty racist, but is also afraid. Right? There's more than one factor. There's more than one Bunsen burner underneath this cauldron of hate that we see rising. And we have to recognize all of those factors and not underrepresent them in our thought process and what we're going to do. So a way to help people understand this environment is to say that scarcity plus bias times dehumanization equals violence. Scarcity plus bias times dehumanization equals violence. Now, it could say, and maybe might say, scarcity plus racism. But I'll tell you more about why I don't use that word when I'm trying to speak to persuadable people about coming alongside of Muslims. So I'm not trying to avoid it. I'm trying to speak to a persuadable group. And we'll talk about that more. I don't have much room for error in my work. Okay? So, at all of our big events, I've done over 64 larger major public events with Muslims, typically Muslim women. We always read the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Because in this hyper-tribalized environment, there isn't much that holds us together. And when people come to our events, I can tell how many people are smiley faces, how many people are sort of not so sure, and how many people are frowny faces, and then we even get some angry faces there. So I got to somehow find a way to make a connection with these folk. And so what we do is we read the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. We claim that we have some values in common. We claim that actually, that I, as a liberal, supposedly, actually love the country and value what we value together. And so we're trying to, like, you know, build us up together in this. But here's some of the things. So there is, however, an active dehumanization campaign that we call the Islamophobia industry against our Muslim neighbors. So folk are actually trying to dehumanize them to the rest of the public. And the consequences of this, I hit the wrong button, is that little kids in our schools who are Muslim, 42% of them experience bullying at least once a year. And we know that this kind of bullying is underrepresented. 25% of the time, the bullying is done by teachers or administrators. So just imagine what that unleashes in that school when bullying takes place. We've all seen bullying. Maybe we've done it when we were kids. Maybe we've experienced it. We know the kind of fire that it lights and the kind of competition it gets going and the kind of violence that it is. We know that total anti-Muslim bias incidents had a 17% rise in 2017, and that anti-Muslim hate crimes increased by 15%. For those of you who live in Western Washington, where everyone thinks it's some kind of, you know, purple utopia, hate crimes actually increased in Washington State by 32% in 2017, outstripping the 17% of hate crimes rising nationally in 2017. So let's talk about what Islamophobia is. Islamophobia is anti-Muslim prejudice and discrimination against both Muslims and those perceived to be Muslims. So let's just stop there for a minute. There was a Sikh man, Sikhs is how people often refer to them, but they actually prefer Sikh, just so you know. There was a Sikh man out like fixing his car, and he got killed because he was wearing a turban, and the man thought he was a Muslim, right? So Islamophobia is prejudice and discrimination against both Muslims and those perceived to be Muslim, resulting from fear, ignorance, political and economic interests, and intentional campaigns to spread misinformation about Muslims and Islam. It is not Islamophobic to ask a question, right? Or to have a difference with Muslims, like, we gotta get over ourselves. We're all different, that's okay. See that woman right there, what's she wearing?
Hijab,
right? And we know that there's a hijab, and then there's a niqab, and there's different sort of versions. It's important to remember that, of course, Muslim men also have a dress code. Did you know that?
Yep.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. I'm glad. Who's this lady? What's she wearing? Yeah. So Muslim women in the Mediterranean world, all women in the Mediterranean world sort of saw and still see to some degree their hair is a semi-private part of their body. Right? And so we always see Mary wearing a veil, right? And of course, we have nuns and all kinds of folk out there, right? So it's just important for us to recognize that we have plenty of evidence in the New Testament and scriptures that people do this and for them and their culture and their religious practice, it made sense. So let's have some basic facts about our Muslim neighbors. First of all, there's about 1.7 billion on the planet. There's about 2 billion Christians. There's about 3.3 to 3.8 million U.S. Muslims, which means they make up about 1% of the U.S. population, which is the same number as Jews made up in Germany in the 1930s. Mm. And that's enough to be known, but not enough to be understood. So the U.S. population, however, assumes that Muslims make up 17%. I'll tell you why in a little bit. There's about 80,000 Muslims in Washington State. 50,000 Muslims in this country serve as medical doctors. 10 to 15,000 Muslims serve in the U.S. military. 20% of Muslims are African American. Anybody know why? Because a lot of those who were enslaved and brought to this country from Africa were Muslim. So 24% of Muslims born outside the U.S. come from the Middle Eastern and North African countries. What's the most populous Muslim country in the world?
Indonesia,
that's right. Arab and North African Muslims make up only 20% of all the Muslims in the world. So, but what we see makes us believe something different. They attend religious services at about the same rate as Christians. They believe other religions can lead to salvation at a slightly higher rate than most Christians. They watch sports, this is really nefarious. They watch sports at 62%, and the population watches at 58%. And who is that guy right there?
Shaq,
and he happens to be Muslim. Did you know that? Nope. And I really hate the way Shaq played basketball because he just backed people down. Like, that's just terrible. But that has nothing to do with his religion, I don't think, right? Right? I love Shaq. He's great. Okay.
Did he grow up in a Muslim household?
Or I believe so.
Did he convert?
I believe he did. Yeah. I'm not sure about that, but I believe I remember that he did. Muslims believe that killing civilians is never justified at a higher rate than Christians. Right? And I think that Christian number is like surprisingly and terrifyingly low, yeah. Right? But only about 38 to 45%, depending now on the number, have ever had a personal experience with a Muslim. That's a Muslim police officer right there. And so we don't know our Muslim neighbors real well because they're only 1% of the population. So before the last election, PPP polling put out this thing with a little poll with folk that were likely voters. And they asked the question, should the U.S. bomb Agrabah? 24, almost 25% were in favor of bombing Agrabah. 51% were not sure that we should bomb this vaguely Arabic sounding name. Anybody know where Agrabah is?
No.
It's from Aladdin.
It's from Aladdin. Yes, indeed. So this is Agrabah. It's a made-up city. Isn't that just fantastic?
That's a little bit nuts.
That's good.
Right. So what that shows, again, is that 75% of the population was like kind of like okay-ish, at least. And that was both Democrats and Republicans, by the way.
Yeah, did you hear about the survey about whether or not schools should be teaching Arabic numerals?
That's
a high percentage said absolutely not.
Thank you for that. 40%
No.
That's going to make it in my presentation at some point. Way to go. I'm looking that up. So we got to ask ourselves why we're so afraid. And of course, I want to unload everything that I said before and everything else that we know about our larger culture, right? About why we're so anxious right now. I mean, right, anxious because we don't feel like our government can make decisions. I mean, there's so much stuff happening right now. Everything's all negative with the news, the whole thing. But we got to ask ourselves why we're focusing so much of that kind of fear and anxiety on our Muslim neighbors. Well, let's talk about that. So this is a little bit old now, but it still seems to be holding up. A group called Media Tenor did a study of religious coverage on Fox, NBC, and CBS News through a 10-month period in 2013. And what they found was that Islam had, in this little pie chart here, half the coverage about religion, even though they make up 1% of the population. So this is why most Americans think Muslims make up 17% of the population, is because, holy buckets, we see them all the time on the news. Christianity, of course, the other 47%. And then look over there on the kind of the bar graph, and you can see that only 5% or so of the coverage of our Muslim neighbors was positive. Some was neutral, and the rest was negative. I mean, I've got lots of other studies that have done said that, like, even the New York Times, the adjectives that they use about their Muslim neighbors are more negative than either their adjectives about cancer or cocaine.
What?
Yes. So that's a group called 416 Labs that did that one. And so when you turn on the news and you're just watching the news, what do you see? Well, you see a lot of Muslims portrayed in a negative way. If you look at movies, Professor Jack Shaheen, who recently died, did a study of all of the movies that had Muslim or Arab actors, or not actors, but characters, thank you. And what they found was that there were only 12 positive depictions in the movies in the last century. 52 were neutral, and the rest were negative. So if you're just watching movies, what do you pick up and see? And then we have this thing that I kind of referenced earlier called the Islamophobia industry. So this group of hate groups, so-called by the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and the ADL, all see these groups as hate groups. And they spend roughly on average between $30 and $40 million a year to make Americans afraid of Muslims. So about a year ago, I was sitting at home taking a Saturday off. I was going to watch some Stephen Colbert on my iPad while I ate my yogurt. And what came up was an ad. It was a really done animated video, a story of a woman who grew up in East Africa, who experienced a lot of oppression in her community, and who blamed all of Islam for it. Mm-hmm. And it went on for like 5 minutes. Somebody paid to have that thing produced, and then somebody was paying to have Terry Kylo watch it in his iPad while he's eating his yogurt. And that ad ran all over the country. I don't deny for 1 minute that she had a negative experience. I don't deny for 1 second that it was terrible. I'm sorry that she experienced that. But I do think that her contention that all Muslims everywhere and all Islam is responsible for her experience. I think that's wrong, right? And so these hate groups spend $30 to $40 million a year, and I use 30 because it's still a lot. And what they do is they write white papers for politicians, they do books, they do YouTube videos, they build networks, they do social media, they do blogs, media appearances, lobbying, speaking tours, and they do messaging studies. So how many people here have heard the term Sharia law before?
True.
All right? The reason why you've heard that term is because they sat down and they did a scientific study about how they could, with an economy of words, make people freak out about Muslims, and they came up with putting the word law with Sharia. And so much so that even some Muslims began to repeat that messaging. You take the word law, compulsion, the word law, power over, the word law, the police officer pulling you over because you're going 65 in a 55, and you add it to a vaguely Arabic-sounding word, which we know we're already afraid of, and you get this really powerful message. But here's the thing. In the last century, 262 million people were killed by their governments, including our Jewish neighbors in Germany and Poland and even in Europe, right? 262 million. And every single time, the population was prepared for that killing, prepared to even participate in it by a process of dehumanization. So dehumanization works like this. Somebody proposes an us and a them. And they cause us, they tell stories and images to cause us to fear them as a threat, even though that threat may not exist. For instance, most people think that if you ask them, if you go to the grocery store and ask them which they're more afraid of, a Muslim or getting shot just by some random person, they'll say the Muslim, right? Even though your chances of being harmed by some sort of person acting on some kind of terrible motivation is like 1 in 1.5 million, but your chances of being murdered by a random gun in this country is 1 in 14,000. So an influencer proposes an us and a them and causes us to fear them. And here's the thing: the fear becomes real. The fear is real when people are actually experiencing fear, even though the threat may not exist. And the fear is around our physical existence, our the vulnerable, and our way of life or culture. And it goes on that they begin to apply collective blame to the whole group for the actions of a few. And then here's the part that we often fail to understand, is that what dehumanization does is it justifies harm against the them, it making the harm necessary and even heroic. So dehumanization is a process where people who otherwise intend well are prepared to either be passive when someone else is being hurt or to actively participate in their harm because it's morally right to do that. I've had members of my own family tell me that it's right to harm Muslims because they're so afraid. And what this leads to, we know, is that it leads to a cycle of violence that decreases everybody's safety, and it leads us to violate our most cherished values, both as a country and as people of faith and as human beings. So in the 1930s, the Nazis printed up lots of posters like this. The Jew, the inciter of war, the prolonger of war. And you can see that the hand is pulling back the curtain, and you got this sort of fire happening in the city. You got these hands raised and fists like we're gonna stop them, right? This is a part of a dehumanization campaign. And you don't have to do too much poking around on the internet to see this. Which is the same poster, but this time against our Muslim neighbors. And here's the thing, haters don't discriminate, most of them. So if they hate Muslims, who else do they hate? They hate our Jewish neighbors. If they hate our Muslim and Jewish neighbors, who else do they hate?
Black
folks. Who else do they hate?
Latinos.
Latinx folk, right? LGBTQIA. I mean, the hate goes on, right? You get that sort of hate going. You start scapegoating them for all your problems. I mean, they're the reason why we're having all this, all these economic problems, why I can't get a job. It's all those immigrants, right? It's all their fault. We just got rid of them. That's that whole scapegoatery thing. But of course, we as Lutherans, we gotta take on gotta remember some of how our dear brother Martin, who I'll have good things to say about later, also contributed to this. So according to Eric Rich, he in this really good article on Christianity Today, he said that Luther proposed seven measures, which he called sharp mercy. They were certainly sharp, but there was no mercy there. To burn their schools and synagogues, transfer Jews to community settlements. What does that sound like? Confiscate all Jewish literature. Prohibit rabbis to teach. Deny Jews safe conduct, appropriate their wealth, and assign Jews to manual labor as a form of penance. Of course, Luther had heard at this point that there were some rabbis trying to convert Christians. Right? And he was at this point kind of grumpy Luther. Right, he had experienced the death of his daughter. So there's a lot of factors for Luther that are kind of like, you know, kind of getting him a little bit worked up. But whatever his intention was, we know what the result was. That there was an anti-Semitism woven into the churches and the theology and the ideology of Lutherans and Germans in general. Just as I said, racism itself is one of those fiery Bunsen burners underneath this, right? So it was in Germany. And as Sam Wells said in reflecting on Bonhoeffer, of course, one of the people in the confessing movement who tried to resist the Nazis, he said that the failure of the church in the Nazi era was obviously an activist failure, a failure to do. But prior to that, it was more fundamentally a failure to see the Jews as those with whom Christians were called to be. In other words, it wasn't just that we failed to act, it's that we failed to know them. We didn't sit down and have meals. We were afraid to eat, you know, a kosher hot dog or something. And so we didn't know each other. And that's what led to a lot of this. Now, across the country, we also know that in 14 states, anti-Muslim legislation has been passed. In over 177 states, that legislation has been proposed. The man who wrote the model legislation, David Yerushalmi, said that his intent with this wasn't really to pass the legislation. I think he's been surprised that it got passed. But it was really to get people asking this question, what is Sharia? And so what's happening in our country is that we actually have people who are hate groups who can now point to state legislatures who have passed laws saying that no foreign law should be able to be higher and more powerful than the U.S. Constitution or state law.
Duh.
Now, is that necessary?
No.
What is the highest law of the land in the United States of America? The
U.S. Constitution.
The U.S. Constitution. That's right. And so do you have to have a law saying that? No, you don't. And so I've actually had people walk up to me and say, well, hey, states have passed laws against this. It must be a problem. And when you ask them the thing, the example of how Sharia is being imposed on people in the country, they have no answer. One person said, well, there's a swimming pool in Minnesota where it's women is only because the Muslim women didn't want to swim in front of men. Well, that's odd. Is that creeping Sharia, or is that just that some women would prefer to swim without men being around? There are lots of other women that benefited from that pool program, too. That's not creeping Sharia. That's just like the YMCA, like, doing a great job. So, but we also got to recognize that we have liberal Islamophobia in this country. So Bill Maher, a witty guy, had a white supremacist on his show, speaks really negatively about Islam and Muslims all the time, about religion in general, actually. He kind of has some intellectual dissonance in himself around religion, saying that, that religions are wrong because they scapegoat people, so now let's scapegoat all religions, you know. That's pretty awesome. And a lot of times, liberal Islamophobia comes up around Islam and women. And actually, today, we're going to have a preview, a world premiere of two little animated videos that we've produced with our Muslim partners that will talk about Islam and women. We also just need to recognize that this happened in America. This was a novelty, kind of a marketing tool of a hardware store in the Pacific Northwest in the 1940s. And could anybody notice where it was, where it happened?
North Bend,
Washington. So when I go around to congregations and they're all saying, hey, you know, we're going to stand with our Muslim neighbors because, you know, we're not going to be like the Lutherans in Germany, I say, well, was your church around in the 1940s? Yes. Did your church stand with your Japanese American sisters and brothers in the 1940s? I've only come up with two congregations that said yes to that. Right? So it's not just something that happens somewhere else, it's something that happens here, has happened here. Another impact of Islamophobia is in sentencing. The average sentence sought for someone who appears to be Muslim is about three times higher than if they're perceived not to be Muslim. The average sentence issued is four times higher than if they're perceived not to be Muslim. And in one of the cases, this guy named Antonio Martinez, he planned to do something terrible. He wanted to bomb a military recruitment and center and shoot people as they fled. His charges were attempted use of weapons of mass destruction. He had 10 articles about him. He got a sentence of 300 months. You know why he got that? Because when he was arrested, he repeated a favorite Arabic praise phrase, Allahu Akbar, which means God is great. At his sentencing, he apologized to the Muslim community because he had never read a Quran, had never been to a mosque, and wasn't Muslim. He was trying to claim some kind of cosmic significance for his violence. But he received more of a sentence than the other two people up here who did fairly similar things, who were not perceived to be Muslims.
And incidentally, he was also Hispanic.
And he was Hispanic, absolutely right. Thank you for that. Yeah, we know how those things pile up on people, right? We call that intersectionality, when oppressions pile up on a person, right? So, and of course, that goes against, all this goes against the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, that that anyone here can be denied equal protection to the law within the jurisdiction of the U.S., right? So, and that has to do with our immigration crisis as well, right? The folk who are in our custody, that are in this country, they have rights. And we must remember that. So what can we do about this? So first, I just want to say that that we need to go back to our core. And I think the core of the Abrahamic tradition, which is quite simply to love God more than tribe or tradition, and to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. The reason I had to add the more than tribe or tradition is because I think when people heard me say love God, they meant our tribalized God. So we got to understand that monotheism was an attempt inspired by the divine, right, to help us recognize other human beings as human. Because at that time, tribes had all kinds of different gods, and when the tribes fought, the gods fought. And whatever tribe won, well, their god must have been bigger or a better warrior. And that made violence a part of the fabric of the universe. So what's happened, though, so what monotheism was trying to do was to help people recognize the humanity of the other tribe, because instead of there being multiple gods authoring and giving birth to different tribes, there's one god who made them all. So no matter what they eat, or what they wear, or how they speak. You can see that they might be human, because this monotheism was intending to help us see all of us as human. And what has happened is that we have retribalized monotheism, for lots of different reasons. We've turned monotheism into the NFL, the National Faith League. And last week it was Muhammad versus Moses. And this coming week it'll be the winner versus Jesus, right? And the winner will be the real one, right? And I'm afraid that's what's happened. So I go into Lutheran churches and I say, we worship the God beyond our idea of God. We don't think we own God. And you'd be surprised at how many folks shake their head violently no when I say that. Because we've retribalized monotheism. And we don't even know what it was trying to do. And second, and more briefly, we have totally sentimentalized love. Love, most of the time, many times in the New Testament, is not about emotions at all. It's about working for the well-being of your neighbor, because we're in this together, hello, right? So what Luther said in the Eighth Commandment, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. What does this mean? He says we should fear and love God so that we do not tell lies about our neighbor, betray her, slander her, or hurt her reputation, but defend her, speak well of her, and explain everything in the kindest way. Which is, I'm afraid, a commandment Luther broke with respect to both Jews and to Muslims. Right? So what this is getting at here, what Luther understands, that this is not just about telling a lie to your mommy. This is about participating in the dehumanization of other people in community, which can lead to violence. And this is also then like a clue about what we can do. Because Muslims make up 1% of the population, there is no way that Muslims can have 99 best friends and help everybody know a Muslim. There's no way to do it. So they have to have allies who are willing to tell positive stories about them. So how do you counter false witness? You tell truthful, heartfelt, experiential witness. So when Uncle Ralph says, well, I know all about them Muslims, right? You can say, well, you know, our faith community had a work day over at the homeless shelter, and the imam of the mosque held my ladder while I was painting the ceiling, and he was really, really great and kind, and I really respect him, and that's all you say. And if Uncle Ralph wants to get you into talking about Quranic verses, is there anybody here who's a real expert at that? Right? Don't do that. Don't walk down that path. Right? And just say, well, you can say, well, you know, that's interesting, because that sounds really different from what the imam was talking about. Maybe sometime we should go down to the mosque together. And I don't mean that as a challenge to his ego. I just mean, like, is that possible? Or is there a way to, like, get him into a coffee shop with somebody for just, like, a half hour? Because it's important that we learn about Muslims from Muslims, not anti-Muslims, the same way it's important that we learn about Christians from Christians, not anti-Christians. And so we got to remember, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, in the end we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. And one of the great sins of the Lutheran Church, and of and not just the Lutherans, but mainline Christians, and maybe just people, is our passivity. Our imagination that we either have to fix a problem to work on it, or there's nothing we can do about that issue. Some people think, well, like, you know, that I'm like doing this work all the time. And of course I work at it full time, but I still go for hikes. You know, I still like pet my dog. I still clean the bathroom. I'm just living life. You know, you don't have to dedicate your life full time to this to have a part. And here's the other piece I want to say, is that this thing about battling Islamophobia is not really primarily on Muslims, it's on the church. So I was speaking to a major rabbi in Seattle, and I said, look, you know, rabbi, I want to let you know, like, everywhere I go, I try to speak positively about our Jewish neighbors too. And he says, I know you do. I've heard you speak. He says, actually, this Islamophobia issue, this one's on you guys. This is on you. This is on Christians. When a minority tradition in this country is being dehumanized, who's it up to stand with them? Well, it's the majority folk. You're supposed to stand up and say, no, like, this is not true. Our Muslim American neighbors, like, are proud American citizens, and they're our friends. And you've heard some false rumors about them. We'd like to help you get to know them. As Martin Luther said, God does not need your good works, but your neighbor does. And right now, your Muslim neighbors really need it. So what can you do practically? So it ain't that hard. What I'm really going to say to you right now is we need to unleash the power of the potluck. Okay? So that's at least a start, right? So eat together, play together, share stories, build strong communities, and when you have that relationship a little more solid, engage in some public issues. So I encourage faith communities to do 3 actions a year. So try to get into a relationship with a Muslim or Jewish or Sikh or Buddhist or Hindu or atheist and agnostic group. I don't care what it is. Get into a relationship and make sure that you're not just trying to relate to one mosque. There's not enough of them to go around, honey. We got to share. Right? So a lot of churches want to have their little Dietrich Bonhoeffer, lapel pin, and say, well, we're hanging out with a Muslim. So that's not good enough. There's got to be a whole community working on that. And so what I want to say is get into a 10 or 15 like faith community thing, and then one time a year eat and share stories, one time a year do a service project, and one time a year march in the parade. And that's manageable. Well, you can weave that into the life of a congregation, no problem. And it'll be super fun to do it. Because as Elie Wiesel said, the opposite of love is not hatred, but indifference. Elie Wiesel also said that when somebody is being dehumanized on the basis of race or religion or any other thing, that group right at that moment has to become the center of the universe. And right now, one of the groups being dehumanized is our Muslim neighbors. And part of the reason why is because some people want to make a lot of money. Because if we're so scared of 1.7 billion people, then we're going to be willing to buy a lot of bombs and bullets and other stuff that they make money off of. And the problem is, of course, that real human beings get hurt in the process. Because this little girl right here, who is welcoming people to the Muslim Association of Puget Sound with that smile on her face, deserves to be just as calm and safe and have a sense of belonging in the store or school or the public park or the bus as she does in that mosque. Because isn't that in the end what we hope for all of us? Because we ain't going to Mars anytime soon. And I really think that that we can make a difference in as Lutherans, as people of faith, whatever the tradition is or whatever your tradition isn't, join with some other folk and make a difference and help us humanize ourselves to each other. And so now I'm just going to show you one video, one of the animated videos that we're producing to kind of help people understand how to do messaging around our Muslim neighbors. Let's see if I can get it to work. And of course not. Okay, we'll skip it for right now. So do you have any questions? I'll try to get it going while you do questions. Yes, sir.
So the figures that you cited in the beginning about the portrayal of Islam,
yes,
in America, how does that correlate to the portrayal of Palestinians in America?
Yeah, so you're raising a really critical issue. So first, I just want to say that it's really important that when we're upholding civil and human liberties across the world, that we are concerned about it in every country in the world, including our own, and that we don't only focus on Middle Eastern countries or on Israel and Palestine. However, having said that, there are people who fund the Islamophobia industry, and Rabbi Yohanan would say the same thing if she were here, who fund the Islamophobia industry because they want to make all Muslims look bad, and by extension, Palestinians. And so there is a connection there. What's been really fascinating is a lot of Jewish groups have been going to some of these funders and saying, do you understand what you're what you're getting going here. And some of the funding is dried up. So our Jewish neighbors, about 90% of our Jewish neighbors think positively of their Muslim neighbors and understand the dehumanization that's happening to them. And so they're among the Muslim community's best allies in the country. So that's just a beautiful, lovely thing in the midst of a kind of a darker part of our country right now. Other questions? Oh, yes, sir.
The slide you showed on the money being spent, the millions of dollars being spent for dehumanization.
Yes.
What are the primary sources of that money? Who's spending that money?
So there are I have a little handout on the music stand over there that will take you to some websites that show you the names of the groups. But one of them is called the Center for Security Policy. They spend about $7 to $10 million a year. They're really wired into the military-industrial complex and some of the folk back in Washington, D.C., like in the State Department a little bit. They have had Mike Pompeo, our current Secretary of State, on their talk shows. And so that's a big one. That's an influential one. Another one is called Act for America, which also gave Mike Pompeo their highest award in 2016 because of what he has said and done with respect to Muslims in America. John Bolton our current national security advisor, ran a anti-Muslim think tank called the Gatestone Institute. But there's about 34 to 40 major ones. They all do a great job of partnering with each other, and then their messages are amplified by between 40 and 50 major news outlets. Their messages amplified by untold Christian bloggers and pastors and politicians. So we have a chart, I don't have it in this slide deck, but we have a chart that shows that anti-Muslim rhetoric goes up before every election. And at the same time that rhetoric goes up, what also goes up?
Violence.
And so it's astounding. But right now, the Islamophobia industry, the leader of Act for America, Bridget Gabriel, I have a picture of her in the front porch of the White House. And she claims, this probably isn't true, but she claims that she has a meeting there every week. I think that was a fundraising ploy, probably. But she's been there some. Right, and so what we're seeing is an institutionalization and even a systematization of anti-Muslim sentiment. And so you think, okay, well, it's not that bad right now, even though we've got the Muslim ban, we've got all these other things going on. Well, what happens next? What happens when Americans get a little bit more fearful? What happens when some person goes off and does something terrible? So it really is a challenge, and we're preparing I feel like our society is being prepared through dehumanization of our Muslim neighbors, of our Jewish neighbors, of our Latinx neighbors, of immigrants in general, of people of color in this country. We're being prepared for a kind of violence that may not erupt right now, but may erupt later, because that's what happens when you dehumanize people. Scarcity and fear plus bias, racism, times dehumanization creates violence. And the thing is, we've seen it so many times before, and yet, you know, and yet it works. And it works in part because some of us are passive, even though we see what's happening. Any other questions?
I have a couple of comments about some things you've done in our church. We tried to have potlucks with a mosque, and we found it difficult to get some of the women to speak.
Yep.
So we had a couple of separate meetings just with the women, with the women in our church and the Muslim women, and they were very valuable.
Yes.
And then two other really powerful things that we did was, one Mother's Day, we had a Muslim woman who's also a science educator, brilliant woman, covered from head to toe. She spoke from our pulpit on Mother's Day. And then also, one of the most vivid memories was we had her come with her daughter to our youth group. And her daughter had actually never been around American teenagers because she goes to a Muslim school. And it was so powerful to see her talk about, you know, how it was an honor for her to share her daughter with our kids. And you know, it was amazing.
Yeah, so, and the thing to recognize, you know, Islam is a complex religion. It's been around, you know, for quite a while now. Islam's, Adam Jamal will be doing a course in Islam late this afternoon. But remember there's the religion, then there's like four major schools of interpretation, and then there's different cultural appropriations of Islam, and there's different nation states that have different laws that are loosely based, just like the U.S. is kind of loosely based on a number of religious traditions, in part. And so there's tremendous complexity. And remember, people that have been part of Lutheran Church or other churches will recognize that at one time there was a Lutheran church in town and a Swedish church in town, right? And so people were trying to figure out, well, what is central to the faith? What is merely cultural? What are the cultural stuff we want to keep? How do we live in America? And then a lot of times, like some of the Muslim communities don't feel always very welcomed in the larger school. And so what do? They have to create their own, right? And so then, we have to keep working together to just get to know each other and break down some of those barriers. One woman yesterday said, hey, that she had done a thing with some of the people in her church to have some Muslim women come and just show the women in the church like what it was like to wear a hijab. So they brought scarves, they put it on, and like the ladies were like, this would be great for a bad hair day. Like it just humanized the whole thing. Like, you know, and so, it's super fascinating how that whole thing kind of works. So I love what you all did, because then what happens is you can tell a story about it.
Yeah.
And so it's not just the event, it's just that we can keep telling those stories, and I can tell other people's stories, and pretty soon we see, hey, we're just people.
And she makes jokes about, you know, people making comments about her hijab, and she makes jokes about, oh yeah, I have a bob under there. I mean, she's incredible. She's so bright and funny, and she also, the other thing that was powerful for me was she believes very strongly she's a feminist.
Of course.
And, you know, even though she's very traditional in her religion, that was really powerful for me.
Well, and so recognize, oh, here, I understand why it didn't work. So I'm actually going to play the second video for you. Okay, because I want to talk about women's rights here just for a minute.
Really quick, can I ask you one question?
Please.
So I agree with you that, you know, humanizing people that we don't understand or, you know, the other is the way to start, especially for people of faith.
Yes.
But I have a question about the dilemma of putting the burden of educating
totally.
Me on the oppressed person.
Totally.
That, you know, you've done nothing wrong, and you just want to live your life.
Right.
And I need you to teach me about yourself
That's
so
right.
that I can know you so that you won't be in harm's way. And somehow that, you know, some people maybe don't want that burden.
Right. So I really respect that question. So I'm going to rephrase it to say, how do we prepare ourselves to be a good ally?
Mm-hmm.
And that means good allies need to do their homework first. So find someone who's a professor or, you know, somebody to come in and do some work with your community.
Mm-hmm.
There are some pretty decent, like, Sunday school kind of, you know, adult formation curricula that you can do to kind of get a sense of some things. There's plenty of stuff, you know, there's some websites I could point you to that also can provide some good information. The difficulty about the web is that 80% of the websites out there are by the Islamophobia industry.
Yeah.
So you
got to
be super careful.
There's
the Interreligious Office of the ELCA. Catherine Laurie is doing a great job on this. You can look at the Shoulder to Shoulder campaign, which I have a link to on that little piece of paper, and they will help give you resources too. So allies have to do their own work first. Number two is an ally. We have to remember that we shouldn't be making plans. You can't plan your wedding before you've had your first date. And so when you get some people together, and a lot of times white churches want to do this, we want to have like a 40-point plan going into 12 years from now, what we're going to do. And I have to like calm them down, like slow your roll, like, I mean, it's not, you know, you just got to go there. go to them, show up at the mosque, get to know some people. They're going to ask you why you want to come. And what do you say? We're a faith community too, and we just want to get to know you. That's all we want. And so you keep doing that work. And then eventually, as you're doing work together, we also, as allies, need to ask a question after we get through with events together. Is there anything that happened today that disadvantaged you or your community? Is there anything that we need to learn? That is a question I ask after every single event that I do with Muslims. And it's painful sometimes to find out that the answer is yes. But I believe that the reason for that, that the power of that, is the power of baptism. That when Paul says in Christ we're called to daily die and rise, part of what he means is to undergo the pain of change and recognizing how we don't love our neighbor in a way that they need. And so I think those are just the beginning of a response to that very complex question. But allies need to do their own homework first and not expect them to teach us and all that kind of stuff. Because think about it. If you have all this like mass of data and questions and dehumanization going on, like, you know how tiring that gets? It's exhausting for our Muslim neighbors. It's like overwhelming. But over time, you can develop those kind of relationships, and then you start giving each other a hard time, and you start laughing and enjoying. So I'm going to show this one about Islam and women. This is narrated by my friend Anila.
What does Islam teach about women's rights? There's a lot of misunderstanding when it comes to this topic, so thank you for asking this question. Did you know that Islam granted a package of women's rights 1,400 years ago that was unparalleled for over 1,000 years in other parts of the world? Prophet Muhammad taught his followers that the best of them were those who treated women well. He further described men and women as committed partners and helpers to each other, and he himself sought the advice and counsel of women and even appointed women to positions of power, like Shafa bint Abdullah, who he appointed as supervisor of the market or minister of finance. As a result of Islamic teachings, Muslim women were in the marketplace, in the medical field, in positions of scholarship, and more. Muhammad even told his followers, women and men, to learn from his wife, Aisha. And there have been thousands of other great female Muslim scholars and jurists throughout history. In fact, the first university in the world was even built by a Muslim woman in the year 859. Muslim women are surgeons, entrepreneurs, politicians, teachers, lawyers, and more. American Muslim women are the second most highly educated religious community in our country. Like me, I'm a Harvard Law School educated attorney who made partner at a law firm and served as general counsel before leaving my legal career to pursue service. There are American Muslim women like Ibtihaj Muhammad and Dalila Muhammad who have brought home Olympic medals for Team USA. There are American Muslim women who are in Congress now, like Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. And even outside the U.S., several Muslim-majority countries have even had female heads of state, like Sheikh Hasina, who is the longest-serving prime minister in Bangladesh. Unfortunately, in many parts of the world, and even here in our own country, women have faced and continue to face oppression and misogyny. In Muslim-majority countries, such injustice is not because of Islamic teachings, but rather despite Islamic teachings that sought to liberate and empower women, as well as all of humanity. Such injustice is because of power dynamics, poverty, warfare, colonialism, post-colonialism, lack of education, bad translations, and more. We agree that women's rights should be upheld. So let's work together to combat misogyny and the patriarchy, but without attacking and demonizing the religion of over 1.7 billion people in the world, especially when that religion could actually help uplift and empower women as it has done and continues to do.
Anyway, that's the world premiere right there. It took us a year to work on these five videos. And it cost about $15,000 to $20,000. Would you like to see one more?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay, this one's on Sharia.
Think what Christianity has done to women. If you were going to judge a religion by, I mean...
Dude, totally. Dude, I said dude.
Dude, you dude's can't. Dude, term. It's okay.
Yes. I think dude's a unisex term because it's a role, not
dude works
a gender.
For me.
But anyway, that's a different debate. So
fine.
Totally. So when Christians say to me, like, those Muslims do these things, like, what do I say? Jesus was pretty clear. Take the what out of your own eye?
Yeah,
the four.
Before you take the what out of their eye?
Slander.
So what did Jesus do? He risked himself to have Mary sit at his feet, which meant what? She was accepted into his rabbinical school to have a public role in teaching. Martha comes out of the kitchen. She's courageous. She's a good friend. She says, are you too sure you want to do this? In a way that culture would understand. And Jesus says, yeah. And so how long has it taken, my denomination to have women be pastors? So, but that's what happens with dehumanization, is that this other group gets otherized and they become the vehicle for everything negative. And so again, part of it is, what you'll see in our messaging here is, we also have messaging studies. There's national organizations that do work for us and help us to be clear about our messaging, right? And so we don't respond always to the negative question, but we respond positively to the concern. And you'll see that, you saw that in Anila's video, and now you're going to see it, I think, in this one too. Let's see if I can get it going.
Term that refers to Islamic teachings.
Here we go.
Sharia is simply an Arabic term that refers to Islamic teachings. These include things like praying five times a day, fasting, giving in charity, being kind to parents, forgiving those who do you wrong, loving your neighbor, standing for truth and justice, similar to teachings of other faith traditions. Unfortunately, there are a lot of conspiracy theories on the internet by anti-Muslim hate groups about Islam and Muslims. Contrary to the misinformation campaign by the multi-million dollar Islamophobia industry, the reality is that Islam is one of the world's major religions and shares many values with Judaism and Christianity. As one of the three Abrahamic faiths, Islam teaches similar stories to the Bible, including about Adam and Eve, Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. Muslims further believe in all the prophets and believe prophets were sent to teach us the same essential message, to love and worship the one true God, and to love and do good to God's creation. Islam further teaches similar basic values of compassion, mercy, justice, and charity, like other faith traditions. Linguistically, Sharia means a path that leads to water. The idea is that just as a thirsty animal seeks a path to water, we as human beings are spiritually thirsty, and Sharia provides a path toward fulfilling our spiritual thirst as human beings. Islamic teachings include the command to follow the laws of the land in which you live. So here in our country, it would include upholding the U.S. Constitution, the supreme law of our land. In our country, one of the values we cherish as Americans is religious freedom. Those who seek to ban Sharia are in fact seeking to ban Islamic teachings, which strips American Muslims of their right to practice their faith. Singling out and seeking to prohibit a minority group from practicing their religion is un-American, unconstitutional, and immoral. Such attacks on our fundamental constitutional values jeopardize the freedom of all Americans. The best way to protect the religious freedom of all Americans is to uphold and preserve the right of each to freely practice their faith, just as the First Amendment mandates. So let's stand united as Americans against attacks on the rights and freedoms of any group, including American Muslims.
Okay, so that's the video. What did you see happening there? What were we trying to do?
Made the Muslims look so friendly.
We revealed that Muslims are friendly.
Right, that's what I mean.
Yes. Anything else?
You unpack the word Sharia in a really concise
way. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, we worked hard on that script. That was the hardest script. And it was the hardest one visually as well. Because what we want to help people to see, of course, with the claim that the anti-Muslim groups make is that Muslims want to replace the U.S. Constitution with Sharia, right? That's false. Mm-hmm. Now, is there a Muslim or two out there that want to do that?
Of course.
Well, sure. I mean, there's all kinds of people out there that say all kinds of things, right? You know, but we don't judge all Christians by the KKK or, you know, or Dylann Roof. Like, it's not fair to judge all Lutherans by Dylann Roof. Exactly. So why do we judge all Muslims by the actions of a few? That's that collective blame business. And so what we're trying to help people understand is that Sharia includes the command to obey the law of the land in which you live, and that Muslims are really happy to be here because Islam essentially has as its one of its fundamental teachings and awarenesses sort of a multi-ethnic, multi-religious community. Because they called Christians and Jews the people of the book.
Right.
So they saw Islam as kind of a continuation of a retelling in 7th century Arabia of the basic teachings of Moses and Abraham and Jesus. Muslims actually believe in Jesus and they believe he's the Messiah who's going to come back and straighten things out. I don't know if you knew that or not. So, but here we're trying to help American citizens who are tribalized around religion to hear some values-based messaging and hear things like we are strongest as Americans when we stand for one another's civil and religious liberty. And when we speak to people out there who are frowny faces, a lot of times they'll soften. The angry faces will stay angry. But the frowny faces and the neutral faces, they will start to shift because we're calling them to some deeper values, which really work pretty well. Yes?
Do you have a sense on how these short animations will be received? And will you be sharing them at these larger gatherings, or is it just a link on the website that you can go to?
Yeah, so we're currently working on a marketing plan for these. So they'll be on YouTube, they'll be on Facebook, and everywhere we and our allies can promote. We're quite certain that when we put the videos out, if they're successful, we're going to get a lot of negative response as well. Mm-hmm. And we do get negative response already, so we're a little bit used to that. But we'll see. But the messaging behind the videos has been scientifically tested. So America was based on freedom of religion. We are strongest when we stand with each other to uphold our mutual rights. Right. We want evidence-based investigations, not bias-based ones. We want our media to tell the stories about violence the same way, no matter what religion that person was part of or not. Like, those messages work in America, and those are the ones we want to tell.
I haven't watched Sesame Street in a long time, but do you know if Sesame Street has taken up any of this messaging, and do they have, you know, characters or people on the show? Because a lot of people across all of America watch Sesame Street with their kids, and that would be a really good place to...
There is an effort underway by folk that are more well-connected than I happen to be to work with newsrooms, to work with production houses about the anti-Muslim, the dehumanizing rhetoric that is often spoken. And most newsrooms want to get it right.
Yeah.
But there's kind of a national narrative that's out there, and most people in the entertainment industry don't want to dehumanize anybody. But there's a whole national narrative that they can't stray too far from, or else people will turn away from them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and people watch the news that tells them what they already believe. So they watch that channel. But Sesame Street kind of cuts through all that because it's with children and it's less, you know, threatening.
A lot of entertainment media does that, can speak across those tribalized lines. So I'll put that in my hopper and I'll talk to my friend about it.
I think some families have stopped watching Sesame
Street. Okay.
Oh, really? Too liberal.
So I know we're supposed to go to 4:15, but how are we doing? Is there another question or two? If not, let's go. Yeah, John.
Yeah, just a comment. You mentioned reluctance to approach Muslim people about, you know,
inundating them with questions or having to answer all your questions. But I've thought about it in terms of, like, if me at my church and if people wanted to ask me about my faith, I'd want to be welcoming and glad that they were curious. And so in the Muslim community, you'll find mosques that have interfaith committees and have open houses that are looking for people to come because they feel really vulnerable. They know all this misinformation is out there. So they're happy, lots of them, welcome people to come so they can tell the true story. Mm-hmm. So you can find those in your community.
Yeah, you have to find the avenue rather than just assume that everybody wants to teach me about their,
no, but
you know.
There are those avenues, you know, depends on where you live. There are those places for you. But again, because they're the ones at risk, so they want the true story out there, and if you're willing to listen to it, they'll give it to you.
And we've seen more of that in the last 4 or 5 years. Because at first I had to tell Muslim communities, we have more friends than you know. And now they're starting to get connected to their friends and be more public. And it's been really great. Yes, right there.
And a real easy one, piggybacking on what this gentleman just said, real easy one is that during Ramadan, there are many mosques who will have an iftar meal, and they invite the general community to come in and celebrate iftar with them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, yes,
Kathy. At our church, we have a Saturday morning activity where we feed probably up to 200 or so meals on a breakfast. And of course, we have the facility, but we don't always have the cooks. And one of the group that cooks for us is a Muslim group. And so finding a charity or something that you can do together that you care about, would be working together, not just finding out about it.
That's a good idea, yeah.
Yeah, and so Trinity Lutheran Church, which Dave and Linda are a part of, has had a relationship with the mosque since 2001. During that time, for a year, they stood around the mosque every time there were prayers to ensure the safety of those that were praying. And they won some national awards for doing that work. And they have ongoing relationships with them. And they do the three things are kind of modeled after them. Eat once a year, do a service project once a year, and then march in the streets once a year. And we've got great photos of them doing that. And again, it's only, you weave it into the life of your congregation or whatever your whatever group you're part of. It doesn't have to take over. It just becomes a part of what makes life cool and interesting. Yes, sir.
Yeah, when you were talking about the difficulty of communicating to congregations about the God beyond God.
Yes.
And there's a book written by Langdon Gilkey, a well-known theologian, called The Shantung Compound.
Yes.
And he wrote it under when he was interned in a prisoner of war camp in China. And he noted, he kept a diary, he noticed that under pressure, people who were the most Christian in their presentation before the pressure came were the least concerned about the neighbor. And many people who had no axe to grind theologically were the most compassionate. And he concludes with the idea of, in order for you to have what he called neighbor concern, you have to put your faith in a reality that goes beyond all human constructions. And it's a good way to get access to that question.
You know, I think what I said earlier is I felt it when I go out and engage congregations. I certainly feel it in my body when I do public presentations. That we're tribalizing our faith traditions. So, you know, and it's a little better in some sense. Like today, if a Methodist wants to marry a Catholic, like it's not that big a deal. But there, some of that is more true now. But on the other hand, there's other groups that are forming their identity as a group against another group, and that is extremely dangerous. And then when God becomes an accessory to that tribalism, well, then all violence is justified. In my hurry to kind of get set up, I didn't bring it up with me, but in my bag, I always carry with me a belt buckle from the German army in the 1940s. And do any of you history buffs know what was on the belt buckle?
Gott mit uns.
Gott mit uns. God with us. God with us. Mm-hmm. Right? And so when we weaponize the ultimate, right, that's called, and claim that we own it and possess it, what's that called within the Abrahamic tradition? It's called idolatry. And idolatry really is an attempt to try to control people's imaginations so you can control and warp the human being, and so you can control and warp the human community. And so, you know, I think, you know, as Douglas John Hall, a wonderful theologian who's been here before, says, God permits theology. Right, but God, I think, maybe doesn't endorse too much of it. I don't think he said that, but that's what he meant. So there is only one ultimate, and that is the God beyond our idea of God. And so I was in a mosque. I'll finish this up with this. I was in Bethlehem. I had just gone in to the place where supposedly Jesus was born, right? Saw the star there, knelt down and touched it like so many pilgrims before me. I came up out of there. And it was a beautiful day, and I saw in Bethlehem Square, I saw a Christmas tree, and at the Christmas tree there were Muslims getting their pictures taken in front of the Christmas tree. And then I heard the call to prayer, and so I walked across the square and I went into the mosque and I took off my shoes and I went upstairs with the men and I sat in the back because I'm related to the Tin Man and I can't sit on the floor. Mm-hmm. And I had this sense of the immensity of God, right? And like in Isaiah, there was that the hem of God's robe filled the temple. The hem of God's robe, and not the whole robe, but just like this little teeny part of it, right? And I sensed how big God is. And we've kind of commoditized and made God small. So monotheism is not the same thing as monoreligionism. I'll say it again. Monotheism is not the same thing as monoreligionism. And I think that thing I just said is not weird. It actually is at the heart of the Abrahamic tradition, that we don't control God. God is the I am, not someone named Fred that we know and can see and touch and feel. And I think to get back to that mystery actually will solve many more of our challenges than just this tribalism that we're facing right now. Thank you all so much for coming. I'm really honored to be here.